Hey everyone out there, and thanks again for joining us here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. We have a neat episode for you today. We have a panel discussion about a topic that we heavily feature in the February edition of ASAP Now, which is disaster readiness. Emergency departments exist for all sorts of reasons, for chest pains, stroke, abdominal pains, the usual. But one of the highlights of what we do is how we are also so critical to preparedness. That is, not only being ready for anything that comes in through our doors, but ready for any volume or surges of patients that come through our doors. And that's where disaster comes in. Whether it be weather-based disasters, mass casualty events, internal disasters like no bed, staff, or electricity, we are ready for everything. So we luckily do not get a whole lot of cycles of practice on disasters, since they, again, luckily do not happen that often. But when they do happen, it's so important that we've had policies, protocols, and procedures to get us together efficiently and as soon as possible. So this episode, we chat about all things readiness, in particular pediatric readiness, because it's a subset that is so rarely featured, but the topic certainly applies to all age groups. Check it out. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, we have got a treat for you this month. We have a panel discussion on all things disaster readiness, specifically pediatric disaster readiness. So this month we have invited three emergency physicians with expertise and articles published recently on either readiness or disaster readiness to join us and have a discussion with one another about what your emergency department can do, how we measure readiness, and all sorts of the literature that is supporting it. So to introduce our panelists, we have first up Dr. Michael Ross, who is an emergency physician out of Emory. He is here with his article, Leveraging Observation Units for Disaster Response, Cases of Efficient Care Delivery in Disaster Incidents. So Dr. Ross, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We have up next Dr. Marianne Gauchy-Hill, who is a emergency physician at Harvard UCLA Medical Center, with her article, Measuring Pediatric Disaster Readiness of United States Emergency Departments. So Dr. Gauchy-Hill, again, thank you as well for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Then last but not least, we have Dr. Mohsen Saidnijad, who I will refer to as Dr. Mo. He was so gracious to let me use his abbreviated name. So Dr. Saidnijad is an emergency physician at Harvard UCLA Medical Center and also the author of the article, Strengthening Pediatric Readiness, the Emergency Department Pediatric Emergency Care Coordinator, PECC module series. So Dr. Mo, thank you as well for joining us.
And thank you as well for having me.
So let's jump right in. Obviously, emergency physicians think about disasters and surge all the time. I personally work in a mostly adult ER, so I don't know that I think about it in terms of children as much, but I thought that's what's so interesting to talk about the continuum of disaster readiness, everything from pre-hospital, ED operations, assistant leadership. So let's go ahead and do a round robin in just introducing each of our panelists with your perspective of who you are, your work, and the lens that you bring to this question of disaster readiness, specifically pediatric readiness. So Dr. Gauchy-Hill, I will let you start.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's great being on the podcast with such amazing colleagues. The one big area for which I have been involved in is the National Pediatric Readiness Project. I was involved since its inception back in 2013, and I'm one of the co-leads for the National Pediatric Readiness Project. And with that, I also serve as a subject matter expert on the Western Regional Alliance for Pediatric Emergency Management, where really this project was conceived and implemented.
So thank you so much for that introduction. Dr. Ross, could you give us your perspective and how you see pediatric disaster readiness?
Sure. I'm a practice emergency medicine at Emory Healthcare, where I serve as chief of service for observation medicine with oversight of six protocol-driven high-volume observation units. And I've been pivotally involved with developing national payment policy for observation services. It's really been my career focus. Years ago, members of the observation section realized that observation units are used in disasters, but it's never really been fully captured, which we did in this paper. I should mention I'm also partially funded by a federal ASPR disaster grant for the Southern Regional Disaster Response System, where my focus is to develop the role of observation units in virtual care. I'm the founder of the Disaster Coalition of Observation Medicine. So thank you for asking.
Yeah, fabulous. I mean, we have a great variety of expertise already with you two. Dr. Mo, could you add your lens as well with, you know, leadership and readiness?
Yeah, I have, just like Dr. Gashahir, been involved with national pediatric readiness for quite a while, going back to, I think, 2015, 2016. And I'm also very heavily involved with local pediatric readiness efforts in Los Angeles County. So way before I got into the disaster readiness space, I was in the everyday readiness business. And the important consideration that I think I'll bring is that the understanding that in order for a healthcare system to be ready to deal with pediatric disasters, they need to have already pre-existing infrastructure that includes everyday readiness. So I'm also currently a co-lead of the Pediatric Pandemic Network Communication Service Corps, and I'm also an executive member of the EMS for Children Innovation and Improvement Center, and both of those entities are very heavily involved with both readiness and disaster preparedness.
So we have a really great breadth of expertise in both readiness and pediatric readiness. So I think during this panel, we'll probably discuss both, even though our focus is mostly pediatrics. I wanted to kick off with Dr. Gashahir. So your paper really talked about quantifying pediatric disaster readiness nationally, and the numbers were, shall we say, not very good. So for the average ER doctor listening to the podcast, tell us some stats, like what should alarm us the most about where the United States is on this particular issue?
I think one thing is for every hospital to develop a commitment to include pediatrics within their disaster plans. And I think that's where we see some of the challenges. Less than 50% of EDs have pediatric-specific disaster plans. In fact, in looking at the 2021 assessment during the pandemic, it was about 46% of hospitals had that. When we developed a consensus-based disaster readiness score, we saw that the median score for EDs around the United States was only 52 out of 100. So that means that there's great opportunity for improvement in this arena, and you can definitely see that by the score. You know, obviously, we'd want to be above 90, if at all possible, for every hospital. We do see a big range, and probably some of the biggest gaps in terms of measuring readiness. One is first having a plan that includes children. Secondly, is including pediatrics within disaster drills. So you really test your processes in order to improve disaster readiness. And then the other challenges, and I think every community has a challenge here, is children with behavioral health emergencies during disaster scenarios, as well as children with special health care needs. So those are the top gaps overall, but I think everybody just needs to start with including children within their disaster plans.
And I love that, because when we think disaster, we don't always think of kids. So thank you for that, Dr. Gashahir. Now, Dr. Mo, in your article about PECCs, or Pediatric Emergency Care Coordinators, you also talked a little bit about those gaps. So in your opinion, how did those gaps show up operationally during actual disasters or surges?
Yeah, so as I was saying before, one of the considerations that I've always seen is that if you don't already have something ready to go in a disaster, then there's no way you're going to be able to respond to a disaster. So these gaps essentially tell us that we were not prepared. We didn't have any infrastructure built. We didn't have processes. We don't have policies that are right. We have not practiced drills enough. And I was just going to add to what Dr. Gashahir just said. The scary thing is that those median scores of 52 or so, that means somebody out there is scoring 20, 30 essentially. And that is extremely scary. And what happens in a real disaster, it becomes really apparent that there isn't anything specific that is already developed for children. And children get lost very often in that. And that is a direct consequence of not having that preparedness going into it. You have to wait until a real disaster happens to start dissecting and see what went wrong. And by that time, you're pretty much behind the eight ball. So operationally, it is clear to see when a healthcare system is not ready, and it shows that there is no way to manage this additional influx of children that coming in after a disaster that require help. And one example, great example of it would be behavioral health. There is no processes how to triage a child who is exposed to a disaster and may come in for a broken arm, but potentially will have behavioral health needs as well because they have suffered a trauma, both mentally and emotionally and physically. So I think that is one of the things to consider, that in real disaster and surges, it becomes clear who was prepared, who was ready, and who was not ready.
And that's so key, is that we don't want to wait for a disaster to realize that we aren't ready, which is why it was really fortuitous. Several of your articles came in to ASAP Now around the same time when we realized, wow, we should put this together as a topic to educate. And that brings me to my next question, which I'll direct at Dr. Gaushee-Hill. Like, we're not doing very well on pediatric readiness. Mm-hmm. From a leadership perspective, what do you think this reflects? Like, is it really just a lack of awareness? Is it a lack of will, structure? Is it an ownership issue? Because obviously it's cross-functional between pediatrics and emergency and maybe other departments. Like, what do you think it's showing us about United States healthcare?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest issues here is really lack of awareness. Sometimes you don't know what you don't know. I will say that the average ED in the United States sees less than 10 children a day in the emergency department. So when you think about it that way, the likelihood that there's going to be an impetus, right, for the organization to address pediatric needs is far less than the balance of the patients that you see, which are adults. So probably one of the most important things that can be done or should be done is assigning the role of a pediatric emergency care coordinator. These are individuals that are assigned the role, okay, to care for these kinds of issues, be a liaison between different departments, as well as to help develop the pediatric resources that are available. And there's a huge number of resources that are available through the EMS for Children Innovation Improvement Center. And so I think it's really a process problem. I think it's a lack of awareness that, oh, we don't have a plan for kids. You know, it's that kind of thing. And I think because children are not on the radar, right, all the time, like adults are, these things fall by the wayside. And so assigning that role can really make a huge difference.
Yeah, I love that. And we'll obviously hit that a little bit later when we talk about solutions. Yeah. Now, I think you guys have done a great job on establishing there is a problem. Like, kids are vulnerable. We definitely don't want disasters in general. We really don't want disasters for kids. And we don't think about that a whole lot. So we may not be prepared, which objectively, Dr. Gaushee-Hill, your article really shows. So I want to really save our time to discuss primary solutions. Now, the first solution I really saw in the articles that we're covering within this panel is obviously observation units. Now, Dr. Ross, this is really the heart of what you were writing about, how observation units are an underused asset, especially in disasters, not just pediatric, but all disasters, because obviously it's a space, it has resources, mm-hmm. How can we mobilize it? Now, Dr. Ross, can you walk us through why observation units work so well in disasters, and then how pediatric patients can layer into that?
Yeah, and thank you to Dr. Gaushee-Hill and Dr. Mo for the great work they've done in describing the deficiencies in pediatric emergency care. I'm going to come at a slightly different angle with the role of observation units in disasters. Conceptually, if you think about it, most definitions of a disaster include something to the effect of an event that exceeds the response capability of the system. It's really, it's about capacity management. And just as disaster preparedness is about capacity management has always been central to what observation medicine does. So if you consider under normal operations, in any given ED, a sizable portion of emergency department patients that are kept in the hospital following an ED visit are what I call the 6 to 24 hour patients, patients that need that more than an ED visit, but less than a day. They represent, surprisingly, between a quarter and a third of all hospitalized patients in the U.S. Hospitals. Now, if you have it's called a type 1, a protocol-driven, dedicated ED observation unit, you can keep those outpatients out of inpatient beds. It's been shown in multiple studies that their length of stay will be half, their cost per case will be half, their inpatient admit rate will be half. It will improve ED flow, ambulance diversion, all the operational metrics. Now, if you fast forward under the circumstances of a disaster, what happens is with any disaster, as you can imagine, there will be a subset of observation eligible patients that need 6 to 24 hours of care. And again, if you keep them in the ED or you admit them to the hospital, you will burn through limited resources. Now, as it relates to pediatrics, and let me just say a lot of work has been done describing the role of observation units in pediatrics. If you search Dr. Sharon Mace, she's published papers. She's got resources on ASAP's website. Commonly observed pediatric conditions include things such as gastroenteritis, dehydration, asthma, croup, seizures, low-risk toxic exposures, those types of things. But under disaster conditions, the observation unit can be leveraged to manage observation-eligible conditions. So, for example, in our paper, we described hospitals where they were suddenly hit with 50 to 70 toxic exposure patients. Because those hospitals had an observation unit, they were able to leverage the unit. And what they did is they displaced the patients that were in the unit back to the ED or in the hospital or discharge. And all of a sudden, they instantly had like a 10, 20 bed unit where they could take in, for example, carbon monoxide exposed patients and mix them with the existing observation patients, or take them in the example of a chemical noxious chemical exposure, fill the unit with all those patients, put them on non-rebreathers, observe them. And by doing that, it kept the ED operating so that a level one trauma center could continue function without missing a beat. Now, those are short-term disasters. Similarly, in longer duration disasters, such as a hospital where the power grid went out and the elevators didn't work, 100,000 visit a year ED that couldn't send inpatients upstairs, that observation unit became a temporary inpatient boarding unit until in the next couple of days power came back on. Or in the case of COVID, where it was a more prolonged disaster, the entire unit ceased to function as an observation unit, and it became a COVID unit until the hospital could adapt and prepare for the COVID patient. So that being said, in all circumstances, in every example we gave, we found that the observation unit played a pivotal role in maintaining ongoing ED and hospital operations.
It's really fascinating because, like, we know observation units are protocol driven, like chest pain, your UTIs, et cetera. And it's interesting to think of disasters that when you have a disaster, it's pretty much one or two things, like clinically, that's coming in. So an OBS unit is perfectly ready to take care of a very specific protocol with high volume and then decompress and triage resources. So I love how you guys think about that. I would love to get Dr. Cauchy Hill, what's your thoughts on if observation units in the presence of them, because Dr. Ross, I think, makes a great sell for why they're great in disasters. Are observation units explicitly captured in disaster readiness scoring usually, or are we, you know, undercounting their value or maybe misscoring someone by not accommodating the fact that they have this OBS unit protocol?
I think they're not counted in the score. Should they be? I think, you know, Dr. Ross makes a great point that they probably should. Most, depending on the hospital, whether or not they have observation units for children. I mean, obviously they can be used. I mean, he talked about several, like rehydration for gastroenteritis, asthma, our classic ones, even DKA in children, that's mild or could be utilized in that way. But we did not put that in because we do not count observation units as part of the National Pediatric Readiness Project. But with that said, his points are very well taken, and observation units can be an area of expansion. And so when we look at, you know, the eight key domains of disaster readiness that we have, one of them is space, that you have additional space, care space to care for these patients in times of a surge. And I would imagine, as it occurred in COVID-19 and other disasters such as Hurricane Katrina and others, that observation units could be utilized in that way to care for really patients of all ages.
So you make a really good point that not every ED has observation units, but it's space, right? Like ERs do often have space somewhere. So for Dr. Ross, for ERs without formal observation units that are listening to this podcast, what's a close functional equivalent that they could realistically stand up or build? Like, I just love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a common question. You know, if the options would be to, again, depending on the duration of the disaster and the nature of the disaster, they could deploy existing space within the ED, which they may or may not have. They could move the patients to maybe an adjacent unit, like a scheduled procedure unit. They could use an inpatient unit. Now one option, one feature that they could also use in this day and age would be virtual coverage. They could use mm-hmm. telemedicine to staff mm-hmm. the patients in this rapidly deployed unit. They could, if it was more prolonged or bigger, you can move a trailer or a tent if you had time to, again, depending on the duration. And again, in two of our units, we staff our units virtually by telemedicine, and we've shown that virtual staffing supervision is not inferior to traditional care in the observation unit and is far superior to admitting observation patients to an inpatient bed. So that is a model that I think if it in a pinch, you could deploy using existing space, put up a temporary space, things of that sort. If I can also, I want to come back mm-hmm. to another point that you raised about protocols. You're absolutely right that disasters, if it's something like a hurricane, most of the observation eligible patients would be things that we treat every day in our observation unit. You know, minor blunt trauma, dehydration, decay, stuff like that. And recognizing that there's a need for protocols for these esoteric things that we'll probably never see. I'll put in a little plug for the SRDRS. If you just search SRDRS DCOM, the Disaster Coalition of Observation Medicine, we've actually developed 16 of those rare observation protocols for carbon monoxide, radiation exposure, radiation acute diagnostic protocol, things of that sort. It's an ongoing project. We hope to add biological and other conditions, but just for just-in-time access, that's a resource that can be used. And also, with regards to Dr. Goshill's point about not being able to pull observation unit availability, ASAP is embarking on accrediting observation units. So hopefully, when that project is up and running, there will exist a field that can be surveyed in hospitals that have observation units.
Very cool. So if you guys are following along in the audience, so far we've established that there is definitely a problem in pediatric readiness in the United States. And there is definitely at least one probable solution with the use of observation units, or, you know, observation-like units, let's call them, if you're standing up something temporary. And Dr. Ross made a couple really good points about virtual staffing of those units, especially because it's disaster and protocol-based. Now, I want to bring up another solution that we have a expert on this call for with Dr. Mohsen, of multiple studies, including one of Dr. Gaucci-Hill's. Now, multiple studies, including one of Dr. Gaucci-Hill's articles, talks about PECCs, which Dr. Mohsen's article really, really discusses in modules of how to educate. So what you talk about here is that having a physician and or a nurse who is a PECC or a pediatric emergency care coordinator, so a dedicated specialist to pediatric readiness. That really helps in pediatric readiness of a hospital, which makes logical sense. Now, tell me more, though, about why does this role matter so much, especially in disasters? Because it is a dedicated person. It's a champion, the way we have like sepsis champions or stroke champions. So what were the key points that you guys came across in your study, Dr. Moe?
Yeah, let me just give you a little bit of framework before I get into our specific study. And I think this is super important. And Dr. Gaoxu Hill and her colleagues published on this more than a decade ago about the fact that most children don't live close to a children's hospital or a pediatric medical center, which is fully capable of dealing with children and sees high volume of children. Most children end up going to the closest local hospital. This is even more so in a disaster where roads are going to be a challenge and getting yourself to the large children's hospital is going to be hard. So you are dealing with a situation where hospitals only perhaps have 10%, maybe 5% of their daily volume is pediatrics. So therefore, there is a lack of comfort, a lack of familiarity with a lot of pediatric specific issues. And therefore, it is important for these hospitals who, as Dr. Gaoxu Hill published, that constitutes 80 to 85% of all children end up in these kind of hospitals, not in a children's hospital. So these hospitals need to be equipped. And a good way to get equipped, I guess the lowest bar is to have a person to be a pediatric champion. And occasionally this person can be an informal role. We call them pediatric champions because they're not formally a pediatric emergency care coordinator, which is a established role. And it has some job descriptions that go with it. So a PEC, as we call it, or a pediatric emergency care coordinator, is the level two. The first level is just having a pediatric champion. We have found that the nursing competencies required and the physician-clinician competencies requirements are all separate and they are both needed. So ideally, one of the things that happens if your hospital has a physician and a nurse PEC, then first of all, you have two people working together. So you don't feel like you're the one person on an island by yourself. And the second thing is that you are covering both the clinician and the nursing processes together. So ideally, you want to have both, but you should have at least one. And again, the papers that have been published on pediatric readiness have demonstrated clearly that presence of a PEC is extremely important and helps improve pediatric readiness score and also helps improve pediatric care outcomes. So the actual role of a pediatric emergency care coordinator is to really think about children in a hospital where children don't constitute a big part of their business. So this PEC, or a pediatric emergency care coordinator, basically is the enforcer, for lack of a better term, is the one who's passionate about making sure that there are pediatric-specific policies in binders sitting there available. There are posters on the wall about specific pediatric clinical care pathways. Make sure that there's training specific to care of children. Make sure that equipments, they first of all have them, and second of all, they know where to find them, because sometimes they have them, but they don't know where to find them, which doesn't really help. Make sure there are quality improvement initiatives that are specific to kids. So these are super important and specific tasks that a pediatric emergency care coordinator does that are instrumental in being able to determine the outcomes. And we do need this as a day-to-day before you can then implement this in a disaster, because a disaster is essentially a very stressed out, short period of time version of everyday readiness that you have to bring all your resources together at once. So this is why being day-to-day ready helps really improve your disaster readiness, and having somebody that helps you become everyday ready for pediatric care is going to then lead to better disaster preparedness. Now, the other point is the having a PEC, keeping your PEC. So the difficulty is that, especially with a nursing PEC, there isn't really institutional financial support and protected time for nurse PECs to do their job. So a lot of times they are doing it at the goodness of their heart. They really are passionate about the work. So that is one reason where there is attrition in the PEC role. One minute you have a PEC, and next minute the PEC is gone, and there is no other person to replace. So we've also found that places that had a PEC and lost a PEC, their score went down. Places that didn't have a PEC and got a PEC, their scores went up. So its sustainability is driven by the constancy of the PEC. So maybe PEC is a little bit better than just a pediatric champion, because at least this is a role with specific job description and a potential transition. But it is important to know this is not a matter of just checking some boxes and having a checklist, but this is everyday passion, walking in every day and looking around, making sure that this pediatric specific consideration exists. Make sure your staff is engaged in simulation, drills, any kind of thing that help them think about kids if they only get 5 or 6 kids a day in their entire 24-hour period. So through different processes and mechanisms to be able to have those pediatric competencies, I want to call them actually, you do need to have a PEC. And as I said, it's important to have a physician level and a nurse level working together ideally.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you highlight something really important about attrition, that this is not just a person you stick in a role to say you had it, but a program really, right? A program of maybe one ED doc and one nurse to say like, this is something that's important. And if the role or the person moves, that we still fill that role. And that role also, I'm sure, works with administration, the medical director, maybe academics, to make sure there's, like you said, simulations on this, training protocols. So, I mean, this is an obvious to me, like, yes, someone that cares will help the topic that they care about, which is pediatric readiness. Now, Dr. Gausch-Hill, relying on you as an expert, I think, in the data part and quantifying disaster readiness, how big was the delta between EDs with PECs and those without them?
When you look at the weighted disaster readiness score, so the consensus-based score, which we used as a measure, very similar to what we use with the National Pediatric Readiness Project, we found a 36.9 difference in scores between those with no PECs and those with had assigned the role of a PEC. And so this is significant for several reasons. One, we know that there is an association, okay, between pediatric readiness and mortality in children. When there are now numerous studies, Dr. Newgard leading a team originally out of OHSU, now at UCSF, looking at large data sets and saying, okay, what happens between highly ready and not highly ready hospitals. So when we think of highly ready, we think of a national pediatric readiness score of 88 or above. And what that has demonstrated is that there's 76% lower mortality in those hospitals, EDs with high readiness versus low readiness. The next thing is that's for critically ill children, and 60% lower mortality for children with trauma. We do know that with trauma, that death occurs generally within the first 3 hours, and that's not enough time to transfer. And so really every ED needs to be pediatric ready in order to be able to do that initial resuscitation that will decrease morbidity and mortality. We don't know how this translates with the disaster readiness, but one would imagine since disaster readiness values, meaning scores, are very highly correlated with the pediatric readiness score, meaning, you know, when you look at the correlation, it's about, you know, 0.88, which is huge, right? So as Dr. Moe pointed out, those hospitals that have good or high or great day-to-day readiness are going to be disaster ready as well. And I think that probably is a big take-home point. But I think we all need to understand that the data is compelling about readiness of EDs to care for children and its impact not only on mortality for critically ill and injured children, but also a threefold decrease in disparities. And so with all that said, The PEC role is really central to this because we do know that the presence of PECs independently improve readiness. They will improve the readiness in all domains identified both for day-to-day readiness and disaster readiness.
Now, that's a lot of data selling why the PEC is such a key role. So, Dr. Mo, you discussed also, you know, the delta in pediatric readiness scores, the cost savings even for having a PEC. From an operations standpoint, is there anything else you wanted to add about how a PEC changes disaster execution in real time when it actually happens?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about when you have been at your best, it is when you have had comfort about it, when you have practiced it before, you've seen it before, it comes natural to you. And I think what happens with having a PEC ensures that you have practiced pediatric scenarios, that you have protocols that are specific to children when it comes to disaster. And one area, which is my area, is mental health disaster readiness in kids. And having those tailor-made to pediatric specific needs. And those things include making sure, like I said before, not only that you have the proper equipment, but you know how to quickly get them in event of a disaster. Making sure something simple like medication dosing. You know, a lot of people who practice adult medicine primarily and only occasionally see kids aren't very comfortable with milligram per kilo or weight-based dosing. And a lot of times, you know, there may be a protocol that somewhere is developed, but the PEC makes sure that everybody knows about the protocol, has seen the protocol, knows where to locate them, knows exactly where the binder is to open up at the time that needed. And all of those kind of things as an implementer, as a person who basically makes sure that the pediatric considerations have been met, I think without a PEC, a hospital that doesn't have a lot of practice dealing with kids, they're going to have a major issue when a disaster strikes. And let's say, God forbid, it's a school situation where the majority of people coming to you are kids. It's going to be very difficult for the staff who doesn't have any preparedness and readiness in place and doesn't have a PEC who have practiced these with them. So that is why PECs are such an important integral piece of this. They should really be included in the emergency response so that pediatric elements are as importantly addressed as adult ones are. It also, in the big chaos and the aftermath of an immediate disaster, by having a PEC-supported process, allows everybody to sort of know, okay, we've rehearsed this, we know how to do this, we've practiced it over and over, so let's do it. We know how to set up triage for pediatrics specifically. We know how to do our surge capacity. We even have pre-arranged agreements with other hospitals nearby that when we overflow, we know exactly where the patients are going to go to. We know a trauma center is closest to us and have planned those ahead of time. So I think that kind of process is driven by PECs. And when you don't have one, it is very, very difficult to otherwise become ready. And that goes from every day, again, as I said, to disaster readiness.
Yep. And the truth is, disaster should ideally not happen that often. So it is something that for sure is you have to mobilize when you have to mobilize, and it's not going to be all that common. So you have to be even more ready. So far, we know pediatric readiness is a problem. We have a couple solutions, actually, observation units and the PEC role. I wanted to change gears a little bit and do rapid fire questions with our authors here. So Dr. Gowshihill, if I am a lower volume community ED director, which a lot of our listeners are, they come from that kind of background, what are the top one or two disaster readiness fixes that you think will give the biggest bang for their buck? Because it's just them and, you know, they don't have the volume, certainly not in PEDS, but maybe even overall, to justify a huge initiative for this.
Yeah, and when we look at, you know, the cost of participation or to become pediatric ready, it's actually very low, from between $4 to $48 a visit, which in today's budget is really nothing. So I think really quick, I would say that if every hospital would have awareness of the importance of pediatric readiness and participate in the national assessment, which is coming March 3rd to May 31st, every hospital can go online and do the assessment at pedsready.org. And in that way, you'll understand kind of where you sit with compliance with national guidelines, which really has been developed by all the major organizations that care for children in emergency settings. So I think that would be step one. And then step two, obviously, would be to assign the role of pediatric emergency care coordinators.
I love it. Now, on to you, Dr. Ross, really as our observation unit expert, what is just one surge strategy that you think every ER should have ready to go before the next disaster?
Very simply, know your options and know your resources. The options are detailed in the paper for how you will leverage your observation unit, depending on the scenario that you're dealing with, whether you'll do nothing or mix disaster patients with your OBS unit or only put disaster patients in your OBS unit, et cetera, and including leveraging virtual care. And then as far as knowing resources, you know, if you have an observation unit, you probably already have an observation unit manual. If you don't, ASAP, or for example, Emory has, if you just search Emory CDU manual, there you can pull up other hospital manuals. And then finally, as mentioned, the SRDRS DCOM website is a good resource to use for those esoteric disasters that might strike.
That's wonderful resources for all of our listeners about using an observation unit. Now, Dr. Mo, we will close with you. With a PEC program, a pediatric emergency care coordinator program, what's the first win? Like, what's the first to do for finding someone for this role, knowing what the role does, having a program for the role? Like, what's the first PEC win that can help build momentum for a new program?
Yeah, I think finding is not so much of an issue as having among the people that are there, somebody willing to do the PEC role. And I think one of the big reasons that being a PEC is difficult is the lack of really good collaboration and institutional buy-in and support from both the local and regional partners. So the first thing to do is to make sure that when you find somebody who is interested, that you really embrace them, you support them as much as you possibly can. You show them that their work is valued. Remember, I told you a lot of the nursing PEC roles don't come with funding. They don't come with protected time. Mm-hmm. So it's a really difficult ask, but they have the passion, they care, and it is important for them not to feel like they're on this little island by themselves trying to shout out about kids' cases and nobody is listening. So I think it's important to have the support. And I also wanted to give a shout out to my co-author on this paper, Robin Goodman, who served in a PEC role for 26 years herself. And she can tell you that the best thing that you can have is a group of friends who are PECs at the different hospitals nearby, who keep engaged with each other and try to learn from each other, best practices, lessons learned, and be able to continue with ongoing activities. So really find the support for the PECs, make sure that they feel appreciated and well-respected, and do everything you can to make their lives easy. And like I said, the dyad of physician and nurse PEC working together is the ideal scenario, but that those are the kind of things. And this is why we did this paper about the PEC modules, because this is kind of what basically shows a PEC what are some of the things that you get to do. So this is all kind of on our EIIC website, emscimprovement.center.
That's a fabulous resource. And again, I want to say thank you guys for all helping with this panel discussion. I think it's such a ripe conversation that pediatric readiness is not something that's always top of mind. But once you do start thinking it, it's like, oof, does it bring a lot of angst? So I think between the data on how are we doing across the country, a couple solutions with observation units, and of course, PECs, I think you guys have put together just such a wonderfully educational panel. So I want to thank you all again for lending your expertise and encourage all of our readers to check out your articles as well.
Our panelists had two disclosures, Dr. Mohsen Sadeninijad and Dr. Marianne Galshi-Hill. Both have disclosures from the Pediatric Pandemic Network, which is supported in part by HRSA of the US HHS as part of the cooperative agreements with 0% financing with non-governmental sources. They also have disclosures from the EMSC Innovation and Improvement Center, which is supported by the HRSA of the US HHS with 0% financing with non-governmental sources. The content presented here is that of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of nor the endorsement by the HRSA, HHS, or US government. Thanks again to all of our experts for joining us and offering their expertise. While you may not be a large disaster preparedness center, you do need to be ready for the potential of a disaster in every emergency department. We hope these situations never arise, but if they do, you will be ready. That is it for this episode of the podcast. The ASAP Now magazine is digital this month, so check us out at asapnow.com. We have, of course, our features on readiness. We got a neat historical piece on EMS and Freedom House with Dr. Kosoko, the viability of hospital on-call systems with Dr. Severance, and columnist Dr. Ken Milne has a great paper review on Sea Callers titled See You Later, Sea Caller, and of course, much, much more every month. As a reminder, on even months, we are digital and we are print in your mailboxes on odd months. Tweet us if you have an idea at ASAP Nation, or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would always love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in. So thanks everyone for listening and joining, and we will see you all next time.